July 22nd, 1983, Redwood City, California. After spending the month traveling through the state, two Swedish nationals, 23-year-old Marie Lillienberg and 25-year-old Maria Valin, leave their friend's residence in order to hitchhike to Los Angeles. When they fail to make their schedule of flight and do not return home to Sweden, they are officially reported missing, and their decomposing bodies are soon found in Los Padres National Forest. 8 years later, the Swedish consulate in San Diego receives an anonymous phone call which implicates a suspect in the murders of the two women, but it does not lead to an arrest, and no one is ever charged for the crime. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and we're going to be exploring a disturbing cold case involving hitchhiking. The 1983 murders of Marie Lillienberg and Maria Valin. Marie and Maria were both Swedish nationals who decided to go on extended vacations to the United States, and even though they did not know each other, they crossed paths while working the same job in Colorado and quickly became friends. Before they traveled back home, the two women decided to spend the summer hitchhiking through California, but unfortunately, they would eventually become the victims of foul play. While the case received substantial media coverage at the time, it soon faded from the spotlight until a surprising anonymous phone call jump-started the investigation again 8 years later and led to the story being featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries. Now, what's particularly interesting is that the anonymous tipster implicated a suspect who just happened to share the same first name of an infamous serial killer from California, and it's unclear if this was the same person who was accused of being responsible for the hitchhiker murders. One of the main reasons I'm electing to cover this case right now is that this person was also looked at as a potential suspect in another famous case from Unsolved Mysteries, which has recently been solved. But we'll go into more detail about these odd connections later on in this episode. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the unsolved murders of Marie Lillienberg and Maria Valin. Our story begins in California in 1983. Our central figures are 23-year-old Marie Lillienberg and 25-year-old Maria Valin, who both originally hail from Sweden. Marie lives in the Danderyd municipality just outside of Stockholm and is studying to be a physical education instructor at a sports institute, while Maria is a preschool teacher from the town of Alingsås. While the two women did not know each other, they both decided to travel to the United States for an extended vacation. Marie first arrived in November of 1982, and Maria in January of 1983, and they each wound up getting jobs as chambermaids at the Vail Ski Resort in Colorado. They instantly bonded and became good friends, so much so that when the skiing season and their employment at the resort came to an end in April, they did not immediately want to return to Sweden, and decided to spend the next 3 months exploring the United States, which included a trip to Hawaii. By the time July rolled around, Marie and Maria decided to spend the month traveling through California, but since they did not have a lot of money left by this point, their plan was to hitchhike. After storing their luggage at a Sheraton hotel in Newport Beach, they would explore the state before returning to catch a flight out of Los Angeles, which was scheduled to leave at 10 p.m. on the evening of July the 24th. When the flight landed in New York, Marie and Maria would meet up with some friends from Connecticut and spend a couple of days with them before they boarded a flight back home to Stockholm on July the 31st. When the two women informed their friends about their plan, they were cautioned about the dangers of hitchhiking, but Maria assured them that she and Marie would be able to sense if anyone dangerous was offering them a ride, and Maria was also carrying a knife to defend herself. They finally embarked on their journey and traveled north before they eventually wound up in Redwood City, just outside San Francisco. After staying at a friend's residence, Marie and Maria began their 400-mile return trip south and were last seen leaving at around 7:15 a.m. on July the 22nd. However, they never showed up to retrieve their luggage in Newport Beach or boarded their scheduled flight to New York on July the 24th. They were also not on board the return flight home to Stockholm 1 week later, which caused great concern among their families. Even though it was common practice for Marie and Maria to make weekly phone calls to their families, the last they heard from either of them was when Marie spoke to her father, Uwe Lilienberg, on July the 16th. They both got into an argument because Uwe was concerned about Marie's decision to hitchhike, but when she called him back a few hours later, she promised she would not hitchhike anymore. When they failed to return home, the two women's families decided to contact the appropriate authorities in order to report them missing. Since they were last seen in the Bay Area, the Swedish consulate in San Francisco would coordinate with the American authorities in order to launch a missing persons investigation. Uwe Lilienberg and Maria's father, Lars Wallin, soon flew to San Francisco to meet up with law enforcement officers who were running the investigation from a command center at the Redwood City police station. Uwe and Lars would both help with the search effort by circulating their daughter's photographs, and they also offered a $5,000 reward and sent out a public plea for people to come forward with information. A couple of truck drivers would report having picked up the two young women while they were hitchhiking, and while there were a number of sightings of Marie and Maria, one of the most intriguing was from a police officer in Monterey, located approximately 90 miles south of Redwood City. The officer claimed he saw them both in the downtown area on July the 22nd, the same day they had left on their trip to Los Angeles, and they were looking for a hostel. While there was one hostel located in the area, it contained no record of Marie or Maria having stayed there. It would not be until August the 18th, 4 weeks after the women originally went missing, when a pair of deer hunters came across a badly decomposed nude female body in a ditch about 40 feet away from Highway 166 in Santa Barbara County. The location was right next to Los Padres National Forest, approximately 35 miles east of the city of Santa Maria. The hunters notified the Santa Barbara County Sheriff's Office, and after they arrived at the scene and performed a search, they soon stumbled upon a second decomposed nude body of a female, which had been concealed underneath some brush in the forest. It seemed likely that the two bodies had originally been placed under the brush together until an animal dragged one of them to the ditch. There was immediate speculation that the victims were Marie and Maria, but since the bodies were so decomposed, their fathers were unable to identify them, though they did recognize some jewelry they were wearing. However, once the women's dental records arrived from Sweden, they were used to make a positive identification. The condition of the bodies indicated that they had been sexually assaulted and stabbed to death. Investigators would soon learn that on July the 24th, the same day they were scheduled to board their flight, Marie and Maria's personal items were discovered inside a dumpster behind a service station in the city of Commerce, a suburb of Los Angeles. This location was approximately 200 miles from the spot where the bodies were found, and the items included their backpacks, clothing, wallets, and passports. Two of the most useful items were a travel diary Maria had written and a camera containing two rolls of undeveloped film, which allowed investigators to backtrack their movements. The last entry in the diary was dated July the 21st, the day before they left Redwood City, which seemed to suggest the victims were murdered sometime on the 22nd. Even though the case continued to receive extensive publicity, it eventually faded from the spotlight until the investigation was unexpectedly rejuvenated 8 years later. On September the 26th, 1991, the Swedish consulate in San Diego received an anonymous phone call from a man who alleged that a male acquaintance of his may have been responsible for the murders of Marie and Maria. The caller claimed that this man hailed from Canada and often made long drives through the United States to Mexico in a white van with a green canoe on top, a trip which required him to pass through San Diego. According to the caller, this person had a hatred for women and had once told him that he had been driving through California in 1983 and picked up two Swedish women who attempted to con him. This proved to be a compelling enough lead that investigators decided to take a fresh look at the case, and it would be featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries, which aired in April of 1992. But here's where things get complicated. The original broadcast of the segment featured an interview with a guy named John Norton, who was the original consul for Sweden in San Diego at that time. At one point, they show a reenactment of the anonymous call to the Swedish consulate, and you can hear a couple of lines of dialogue from Norton's interview, in which he mentions that the caller implicated a man named Lauren. However, if you go watch the segment, which is currently available on the official Unsolved Mysteries FilmRise channel on Amazon Prime and YouTube, you'll notice that a few lines of dialogue are conspicuously missing. Even though they still feature the reenactment with the anonymous phone call, all of John Norton's mentions of the name Lauren have been cut out. In addition, you might notice that the segment on the FilmRise channel seems to end rather abruptly. Well, that's because they cut out an update segment, which aired for years in syndication, in which Robert Stack mentioned that after this story originally aired, Unsolved Mysteries received a tip, which led investigators to the mysterious Lauren, and the anonymous caller was also identified. The Santa Barbara County Sheriff's Office performed a search of Lauren's apartment and allegedly found evidence which seemed to further implicate him in the hitchhiker murders, but there was not enough evidence to charge him. Unfortunately, I have been unable to find out why all this material about Lauren has been cut out of the FilmRise version of the Unsolved Mysteries episode, but this might imply that the entire lead involving him was nothing more than a dead end. We'll talk more about Lauren later on, but there have not been any more notable developments in this case in quite some time, so the murders of Marie Lilienberg and Maria Valin remain unsolved. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Anyway, this is far from the only case I've covered on The Trail Went Cold in which someone was murdered or went missing while they were hitchhiking. And even though our society is well aware of the dangers of hitchhiking today, it was a much more common practice during the 1970s and early 1980s. Both the Unsolved Mysteries segment and the original media coverage of this case put a heavy emphasis on the cultural differences between Sweden and the United States, which might explain why Marie Lilienberg and Maria Valin felt compelled to ignore the warnings they received about hitchhiking and decided to use it as their means of travel through California. It was pointed out that Sweden is a much smaller country than the US and only had a population of just over 8 million people back in 1983, which was only about a third of the entire population of California at that time. But the key difference was that the crime rate was so much lower. People were generally more trusting of each other in Sweden, which was why hitchhiking was much more commonplace there. In fact, I read that if you wanted to hitchhike through Sweden during that time period, and you didn't feel like paying for any lodgings, you could just stop by a farm and ask the owner if you could set up a tent on their property to spend the night, and they'd happily oblige without any issues. The Unsolved Mysteries segment featured an interview with a truck driver named Mark Hansen, who said that he gave Marie and Maria a ride from San Diego to Compton, but openly expressed his concern about their decision to hitchhike. When Hansen dropped the two women off, he placed them in the company of another truck driver he trusted, who gave them a ride to Oakland, so it's a cruel twist of fate that they wound up getting murdered anyway during the final leg of their trip. At that time, California was probably one of the states which was most aware of the dangers of hitchhiking, as it was the site of the infamous Santa Rosa hitchhiker murders, where a total of 7 young female hitchhikers, some of whom were as young as 12 and 13 years old, were killed in Sonoma County in 1972 and 1973. Those murders are all still unsolved to this day, and while there's no evidence to suggest that the Swedish hitchhiker deaths are connected to them, I guess you can't completely rule anything out. But given the preponderance of serial killers who operated in California during the 1970s and 80s, it was definitely not a safe place to hitchhike. I know it can sometimes be a bureaucratic nightmare whenever a foreign national goes missing while visiting another country, but this investigation was coordinated remarkably well, as the American authorities immediately leaped into action once it was reported that Marie and Maria had disappeared. Their case received a lot of coverage in the California media, both before and after the remains were discovered, and the authorities did a pretty thorough job at exploring every possible lead. While the investigation eventually reached a dead end, the strange anonymous call to the Swedish consulate in 1991 brought it back to life, but it also led to a number of other unanswered questions, which we'll talk about momentarily. Overall, it's really not hard to figure out what likely happened to the two women. They were last seen leaving their friend's place in Redwood City on July the 22nd, and their personal items were discovered in a dumpster in the City of Commerce 2 days later. The last entry in Maria's travel diary was dated July the 21st, and since she usually wrote at least one entry per day, it's reasonable to assume that both women were murdered a short time after leaving Redwood City. When the case made the news, a number of eyewitnesses came forward who believed they had seen the two women, but I think that most of them were probably mistaken, as a number of these sightings took place after July the 22nd, which is when Marie and Maria are believed to have been murdered. However, the one sighting which might be credible is the police officer who believed he interacted with the women in Monterey on the 22nd, where they were apparently looking for a hostel to stay at. While there was no record of them having checked in to the local hostel, Monterey is about 95 miles south of Redwood City, so it's not implausible that someone could have given them a ride there before they crossed paths with the person who murdered them. In fact, if this person offered them a ride, that would explain why they elected not to stay at the hostel. Now, it is interesting how the two women's personal items were eventually discovered in a dumpster about 200 miles from the location in Los Padres National Forest where their bodies were found. It wouldn't surprise me if the perpetrator did this intentionally in order to create misdirection with the investigation, but that's still quite a long distance to drive to dispose of evidence, which makes you wonder if the killer was a truck driver or someone who picked up Marie and Maria while they were passing through the area. Also, since subduing, sexually assaulting, and fatally stabbing two women would have been a difficult task for just one person, you can't dismiss the possibility that multiple perpetrators might have been involved. Now, the suspect who was implicated in the anonymous phone call was described as someone who often drove through California to take trips to Mexico and would stop in San Diego to visit the caller. While we know the killer dumped the victims' bodies in Santa Barbara County before driving southeast through Los Angeles to dispose of their personal items, and since San Diego was further south, the geography would fit. I previously mentioned that the suspect was named Lauren, which is obviously not the most common male name out there. So if you have an extensive knowledge of true crime, I'm sure the first suspect who popped into your mind was Lauren Herzog, one half of the notorious Speed Freak Killers. Throughout the 1980s and 90s, Lauren Herzog and his partner, Wesley Shermantine, committed a number of murders in California and were nicknamed the Speed Freak Killers because they were often under the influence of methamphetamine. Both men were arrested in March of 1999 because of their suspected involvement in the disappearance of 25-year-old Cindy Vanderheiden, which had taken place 4 months earlier. Even though Vanderheiden's body had not been found, DNA testing confirmed the presence of her blood in Schermantine's car, and while Herzog was being interrogated, he confessed to their involvement in several other crimes, including the 1984 murders of Howard King and Paul Kavanaugh, two men whom they had decided to fatally shoot and rob inside their car. In 2001, Schermantine was tried and convicted of the murders of Vanderheiden, King, Kavanaugh, and 16-year-old Chevelle Wheeler, who had gone missing while visiting Schermantine's cabin in October of 1985, though her body had still not been found by this point. Schermantine was sentenced to death for his crimes, and is currently still on death row at San Quentin State Prison. Herzog also wound up being convicted of the murders of Vanderheiden, King, and Kavanaugh, as well as an additional accessory to murder charge for the 1984 shooting death of a man named Henry Howell, and he would receive a sentence of 78 years in prison. However, in 2004, a state appeals court decided to overturn all of Herzog's convictions after ruling that the police had improperly coerced the confessions he made to the crimes. Rather than go on trial again, Herzog agreed to a plea deal in which he would plead guilty to the lesser charges of involuntary manslaughter and the death of Cindy Vanderheiden, and being an accessory to the other three murders. In exchange, he would receive a 14-year prison sentence, with credit for time already served. Herzog also shaved an additional few years off his sentence for good behavior, which made him eligible for parole in 2010. Well, needless to say, even though some questionable things had been done during the original police investigation, there was zero doubt that Herzog was actually guilty of all these crimes, so there was fierce opposition to his release from prison. Since none of the counties in California wanted to take him for parole, an arrangement was made with the California Department of Corrections, where Herzog would be released under very restricted supervision and confined to a trailer located outside the front gate of the High Desert State Prison in Lassen County. Herzog lived under this arrangement for just over a year, until he suddenly decided to take his own life by hanging himself in January of 2012. Since Wesley Schermantine was still on death row, he was none too pleased about his partner in crime being able to walk out of prison, so he made an arrangement to lead the authorities to a site containing the remains of some other victims whom the Speed Freak killers had not yet been linked to. This obviously meant that Herzog could be charged with additional murders and wind up back in prison, which was the likely motivation behind his suicide. Schermantine finally provided the locations where Cindy Vanderheiden and Chevelle Wheeler had been buried, and the remains were finally recovered, and he would also disclose the location of an abandoned well located just outside his former hometown of Linden. A search of this well turned up over 1,000 human bone fragments, and DNA testing would soon determine that many of the bones belonged to a pair of young women who had gone missing from the city of Stockton. 19-year-old Kimberly Ann Billy, who vanished in December of 1984, and 16-year-old Joanne Hobson, who vanished in August of 1985. The skeletal remains of another young female and a fetus were also found in the well, and while this victim was likely murdered while she was pregnant, she has never been identified. Now, you might recall me mentioning during the intro that Lauren Herzog was looked at as a potential suspect in another famous case from Unsolved Mysteries. On November the 19th, 1988, 9-year-old Michaela Gerricht and a friend of hers rode their scooters to a market in the town of Hayward, California, but after they exited the store, they discovered that Michaela's scooter had been moved into the middle of the parking lot. When Michaela went over to retrieve it, an unidentified young man with long, dirty blonde hair emerged from a nearby parked car and abducted Michaela before he drove away. Well, sometime after Lauren Herzog's suicide, Wesley Schermantine wrote a letter to the newspaper, the Stockton Record, alleging that his former partner was responsible for Michaela's disappearance. DNA testing ruled out the possibility that any of the bone fragments found in the well belonged to Michaela, but Herzog undeniably had a resemblance to the unidentified blonde man who abducted her, so he could not be completely eliminated as a suspect. However, on December the 21st, 2020, less than 2 months before the release of this episode, it was announced that another suspect, 59-year-old David Misch, have been charged with Michaela's kidnapping and murder. For the past 3 decades, Misch had been incarcerated for the murder of a woman named Margaret Ball, and in recent years, DNA evidence has also linked him to the 1986 murders of 2 other women, Michelle Xavier and Jennifer Dewey. At the time of this recording, Michaela's remains have still not been found, but Misch was implicated in her abduction after his fingerprints were found on Michaela's scooter. I may talk more about the Michaela Gericht case on a future episode, but it now seems likely that Lauren Herzog had no involvement in her disappearance. So that brings us back to our main topic. Could Herzog have been responsible for the murders of Marie Lilienberg and Maria Valin? And if he was, could Wesley Shermantine have also been involved? After all, it's been suspected that the Speed Freak killers were responsible for additional murders they have still not been linked to, and their final victim count might be somewhere in the double digits. I know that Herzog would have only been 17 years old at the time the hitchhikers were murdered, but given that his first confirmed murders took place only 1 year later, that hardly disqualifies him from being the perpetrator. While I'm sure it's tempting to believe that Lauren Herzog was the mysterious Lauren mentioned during the Unsolved Mystery segment, since what are the odds that 2 separate serial killers named Lauren were operating in California during that time period? But since all references to Lauren's name have been eliminated from the version of the episode currently streaming on the official FilmRise channels, does this now mean that lead is completely pointless? I know that there are many Unsolved Mystery segments which are currently not available for viewing on Amazon Prime or YouTube, and the vague reason they always give is that it's for quote-unquote legal reasons. But their segment about the Swedish hitchhikers is the only one I know of in which they cut out a few lines of dialogue from an interview which make reference to a specific individual. I mean, if Lauren Herzog was the Lauren in question, is there really any need to protect the reputation of a convicted murderer who has since killed himself? While the issue is that no official source has ever confirmed that Herzog was looked at as a potential suspect in this crime, even after his suicide took place, and as far as I can tell, Shermantine has not implicated him. And the fact of the matter is that there were details provided by the anonymous caller which do not match Herzog at all. Remember, the caller said that Lauren originally hailed from Canada and often drove through California on trips to Mexico, but Herzog hailed from the farming town of Linden and has no links to Canada that I know of. Linden is over 300 miles away from the location where the victims' bodies were found, and I see no indication that Herzog ever drove a white van with a green canoe on top. In addition, the caller described Lauren as being over 6 feet tall and weighing 175 pounds with a slight build and having a long protruding nose and thinning red hair. Well, Herzog had long, dirty blonde hair, and I would hardly describe his nose as protruding. Other than the fact that they share the same first name and were both committing murders in California during that time period, there's really nothing to suggest that Herzog and this other Lauren are one and the same. Now, the Unsolved Mystery segment originally aired in 1992, and Herzog was not arrested until 7 years later, so I guess it's certainly possible that investigators did look at him as a possible suspect, but if they did, I get the feeling he might have been cleared. I still don't know what to make of that original Unsolved Mysteries update, where Robert Stack said that the authorities had tracked down the anonymous caller and determined Lauren's identity. They said Lauren's apartment was searched, and additional evidence was found which seemed to implicate him in the murders. You get the impression that investigators were edging very close to gathering enough evidence to charge Lauren, but then after that, there was nothing, and this original update is no longer available for viewing. So did they conclusively determine that Lauren was not involved in the crime? Well, the circumstances of the anonymous tip are pretty bizarre, since it was not phoned in until 8 years after Marie and Maria were murdered. I don't believe the case had been featured in the media for quite some time, so it sounds like the tip came completely out of nowhere. It's also odd that the caller phoned the Swedish consulate in San Diego, since the women were last seen in the Bay Area, and the Swedish consulate in San Francisco coordinated the investigation, but this might be because the caller lived in San Diego. It sounds like Marie and Maria did travel south and visit San Diego after they dropped off their luggage in Newport Beach, as that's where the truck driver, Mark Hansen, picked them up before they headed north. So the story seems to be that Lauren stopped by to visit the anonymous caller in San Diego, and that's where he allegedly made some incriminating statements about picking up two Swedish women. But from the details provided in the Unsolved Mystery segment, it doesn't sound like Lauren actually said anything to imply that he murdered them, only that the Swedish women attempted to con him. And since Lauren supposedly hated women, the caller might have jumped to the conclusion that this drove Lauren to murder them. However, could it be possible that Lauren actually did pick up Marie and Maria at some point in 1983, but was not actually responsible for their deaths? I don't know what Lauren would have meant when he said they tried to, quote-unquote, con him, but it could have angered him enough to drop the women off, and they were subsequently murdered by someone else who picked them up and gave them a ride. When you look at the situation from that perspective, I can see how Lauren might have been falsely implicated in this crime, but what was the additional evidence found in his apartment, which supposedly pointed towards him being the perpetrator? It's frustrating that we don't have this information, but I have to wonder if investigators eventually found some sort of proof that Lauren could not have been involved, so all mentions of his name have been removed from the Unsolved Mystery segment to prevent him from facing any sort of potential backlash. This seems like a pretty bizarre side story, and I'm not sure we'll ever learn the full details about it, but it opens up the question. If Lauren was not actually responsible for the murders of the two Swedish hitchhikers, then who was? Well, unfortunately, the problem is that it pretty much could have been anyone. This is not a very complex crime, as it seems likely that Marie and Maria just simply hitched a ride with the wrong person who murdered both of them and subsequently disposed of their bodies in a remote forest and did not leave behind any evidence which could be traced back to them. Back in 1983, no one would have been thinking about DNA, but you have to wonder if any forensic evidence might still be available on the victims' bodies or the items which were found in the dumpster in the City of Commerce. I mean, I previously made reference to the recent arrest and the Michaela Garrick disappearance, and up until that happened, I had no idea that the abductor's fingerprints had been left behind on her scooter, which is what finally allowed them to link the crime to a suspect. This is why I'm hoping there's DNA or other forensic evidence which can potentially lead to a suspect in this particular case. Even back in the 1980s, some of the investigators were flat out expressing their belief to the media that the chances of solving this crime were not high, until that strange anonymous call led to the case receiving additional exposure on Unsolved Mysteries. But in spite of this, it seems like the investigation has once again reached a dead end. As it is right now, this story does function as a cautionary tale about the dangers of hitchhiking, as well as a time capsule into how much different the world was back in 1983. But it would still be nice for this story to finally have some conclusive answers, so if you happen to have any information about the murders of Marie Lilienberg and Maria Valen, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now, the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, I released an episode about the notorious Zip Gun Bomber, an unidentified individual who sent booby-trap packages to a number of different people that were rigged with a homemade zip gun device which fired off bullets when the packages were opened. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to take a moment to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Kimberly, Sarah, Sharina T., Evan W., Danielle H., Alma C., and Julie E. Thank you all so much for your support. And before we bring this episode to a close, I'd like to play a promo for another true crime podcast, the DNA ID Podcast.
Jody Loomis, Jessica Baggin, Kelly Ann Prosser, Michelle Martinko, Christy Mirak, Carolyn Rose. Do these names mean anything to you? All these people are murder victims whose cases were cold for decades until recently. They were solved by investigative genetic genealogy. This new crime-solving tool is rapidly providing us with the names of elusive killers. But each one of these cases is unique and worth exploring. Each episode of the DNA ID podcast will focus on one newly solved case and look at the story behind the headline. Who was the victim? Who was their killer? And why did this tragic crime occur? It's brought to you by Abject Entertainment, hosted and produced by me, Jessica Betancourt, and co-produced by Mike Morford. Make sure you subscribe to DNA ID today, wherever you listen to podcasts, so you don't miss a single episode.
I'd also like to announce that later this year, provided that it becomes safe to travel again, The Trail Went Cold is going to be appearing on Podcast Row at two separate CrimeCon events. The regular CrimeCon, which takes place at the Fairmont Hotel in Austin, Texas, from June 4th until the 6th, and the very first CrimeCon UK, which is being held at the Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa in London the following weekend on June 12th and the 13th. If you would like to purchase tickets to either event, we have a special promo code you can use to get a 10% discount, and it applies to both the Austin and London events. So to receive 10% off, either visit crimecon.com or crimecon.co.uk and enter the promo code COLD21. That's COLD21. In addition, I also wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes of every episode, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvocal.com. That's GETVOKL.com. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the ear music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. Anyway, as hard as it might be to believe, this podcast is now on the verge of reaching a very special milestone. That's right, next week will officially mark the 5-year anniversary of The Trail Went Cold, and we're going to commemorate the occasion with an in-depth exploration of one of our most highly requested cold cases. So have yourself a good week, and join us next Wednesday for a very special anniversary episode of The Trail Went Cold.